those words. We are going to fight Kern, and we are going to fight that. We are coming home. You hear me? That's home now. It's all the home we'll ever have. And we will mass drive the fucking place from orbit if we have to make it ours. We'll burn them out. We'll burn them all out. What else have we got? He rubbed at his face. When he took his hands away, he seemed composed. Right. I need more minds on this. Alpash, it's time. The engineer nodded. Time for what? Holston demanded. Time to wake up Lane, Cast replied. Chapter 7.2 What Rough Beast. Far beyond the physical tendrils with which they have ringed their planet, the spiders have extended a wider web. Biotechnological receptors in the cold of space hear radio messages, await the return of soundless calls into the void, and reach out for disturbances in gravity and the electromagnetic spectrum. The tremors on the strands that will let them know when a guest has arrived in their parlour. They have been preparing for this day for many generations. The entire planet has, ever since they finally bridged that gap with God, fingertip to leg tip. Their entire civilization has come together with a purpose, and that purpose is survival. The messenger had forever been trying to prepare them, to mould them into her image and give them the weapons she thought they needed in order to fight back. Only when she stopped treating them like children, like monkeys, was she able to do what perhaps she should have done from the start, communicate the problem to them, let them find a solution that was within the reach of their minds and their technology. One advantage of God ceasing to move in mysterious ways is that the entire planet has found a hitherto unknown unity. Little focuses the collective mind more decisively than the threat of utter extinction. The messenger was unstinting in her assurances that the spiders would have nothing else to look forward to if the Gilgamesh was allowed to return unopposed. She had racked her piecemeal recollection of her species' history and found only a hierarchy of destruction, of her species devastating the fauna of planet Earth and then turning on its own sibling offshoots, and then at last, when no other suitable adversaries remained, tearing at itself. Mankind brooks no competitors, she has explained to them, not even its own reflection. For generations, then, a political unity of the spider cities has worked towards creating this vast orbital presence, using all the tools available. The spiders have entered the space age with desperate vigour. And Bianca looks up at the darkening sky, at the unseen filigree of Great Star Nest, the orbital city, and knows that she would rather this had not come about in her lifetime. The enemy is coming. She has never seen this enemy, but she knows what it looks like. She has sought out ancient understandings, preserved across the centuries, that reach back to a time when her kind faced extinction at the jaws of a much more comprehensible foe. For during their conquest of the ant supercolony, Bianca's species encountered what she now knows as humanity. There were giants in the world, back in those days. She now sees, through the long-gone eyes of a distant ancestor, the captive monster that had fallen from the sky, not from the messenger, as had been believed, but from this approaching menace. Little did they know, it was a herald of the end. It seems so hard to believe that such a huge, ponderous thing could have been sentient, but apparently it was. More than sentient. Things like that, just as the messenger had once been a thing like that, are the Ur-race, the ancient astronauts responsible for all life that has evolved on Bianca's world. And now they are returning to undo that mistake. Bianca's musings have taken her out of the vast reach of the Seven Trees conurbation and on to the closest anchor point, travelling swiftly by wire in a capsule powered by artificial, photosynthetic, self-sufficient muscle. Now she disembarks, feeling the great open space around her. Most of her world's tropical and temperate land area is still forested, either for agricultural purposes as wild reserves, or serving as the scaffolding that her species use to build their cities. The areas around the elevator anchor points are all kept clear, though, and she sees a great tent of silken walls 100 feet high, culminating in a single point that stretches ever away into the high distance, beyond the ability of her eyes to follow it. She knows where it goes, though, heading up, up out of the planet's atmosphere, then up further and further, as a slender thread that reaches halfway to the arc of the moon. The equator is studded with them. That long-ago balloonist was right. There was an easier way to claw one's way up and out of the planet's gravity well, and into orbit, and all it took was spinning a strong enough thread. Bianca meets with her assistants, a subdued band of 5 females and 2 males, and they hurry inside to another capsule, this one moving by little more than simple mechanical principles utilized on a grand scale. Unimaginably far away is a comparable weight even now descending inwards towards the planet's surface. By exercise of the sort of mathematics that Bianca's species has been fluent in for centuries, Bianca's own car begins its long, long ascent. She is the general, the tactician. She is going to take her place amidst the bustling community known as Great Star Nest to mastermind the defence of her planet against the alien invaders, the star gods. She has ultimate responsibility for the survival of her species. A great many better minds than hers have formulated the plan that she will attempt to carry out, but it will be her own decisions that will make the difference between success and failure. The journey up is a long one, and Bianca has plenty of time to reflect. The enemy they face is the child of a technology she cannot conceive of, advanced beyond the dreams of her own kind's greatest scientists, using a technology of metal and fire and lighting, all fit tools for vengeful deities. At her disposal is fragile silk, biochemistry and symbiosis, and the valour of all those who will put their lives at her disposal. Fretting, she spins and destroys, as she and her fellows are hauled towards the open darkness of space, and the gleaming grid of her people's greatest architectural triumph. Already in orbit on the globe-spanning three-dimensional sculpture they think of as Great Star Nest, Portia is steeling herself for a fight. The great equatorial web is studded with habitats that trail out from one another, interconnect, are spun up or taken down. It has become a way of life for the spiders, and one they have taken to remarkably quickly. They are a species that is well made for a life of constant freefall around a planet. They are born to climb and to orient themselves in 3 dimensions. Their rear legs give them a powerful capacity to jump to places that their keen eyes and minds can target precisely, and if they get it wrong, they always have a safety line. In a curious way, as Portia and many others have considered, they were born to live out in space. The old cumbersome spacesuits which once took those pioneering balloonists to the outer reaches of the atmosphere are things of the past now. Portia and her squad traverse the lattice-strung vacuum quickly and efficiently, setting out on manoeuvres to ready themselves for the coming conflict. They carry most of their suit about their abdomens, book lungs fed by an air supply that is chemically generated as needed, rather than stored in tanks. With their training and their technology, and their relatively undemanding metabolisms, they can stay out in raw space for days. A chemical heating pack is secured beneath their bodies, along with a compact radio. A lensed mask protects their eyes and mouths. At the tip of each abdomen, their spinnerets connect to a little silk factory, spinning chemical silk that forms strands, formidably strong strands, in the airless void. Lastly, they have packs of propellant with adjustable nozzles to guide their silent flight in the void. Their exoskeletons have been coated in a transparent film, a single molecule thick, which prevents any decompression or moisture loss without diminishing much in the way of feeling. The tips of their legs are sheathed in insulating articulated sleeves to guard them from heat loss. They are the complete astronaut soldiers. As they cross from line to line, judging each leap effortlessly, they are swift and agile and utterly focused. The enemy is coming at last, just as the messenger foretold. The concept of holy war is alien to them, but this looming conflict has all the hallmarks. There is an ancient enemy that they know will negate their very existence if they cannot defend themselves. There are weapons that, try as they might, they cannot even conceive of. The messenger did her best to set out for them the technical and martial capabilities of the human race. The overwhelming impression received was of a terrifying and godlike arsenal, and Portia is under no illusions. The best defence her people have is that the invaders want their planet to live on. The worst excesses of Earth technology cannot be deployed without rendering the prize that both sides fight for worthless. But there are still a great many unpredictable weapons the Gilgamesh could conceivably possess. The spiders have done what they could in the generations allowed to them, having considered the threat and prepared what is to them the best technological and philosophical response. There is an army. Portia is one of hundreds who will serve on the front line, one of tens of thousands whose turn will likely come to fight. They will die, many of them, or at least that is what they expect. The stakes are so high, though. Individual lives are ever the chaff of war. But if there was ever a just cause, it is this. The survival of an entire species, of a whole planet's evolutionary history, is now at stake. She has heard that Bianca is on her way up. Everyone is glad, of course, that the commander of their global defence will be up here alongside them. But the simple fact that their leader is on her way brings it home to all of them. The time is finally here. The battle for tomorrow is beginning. If they lose, then there will be no future for them. And with that severed tomorrow, all their yesterdays will be undone as well. The universe will turn, but it will be as though they had never existed. Portia knows that the great minds of her species have considered many diverse weapons and plans. She must take it on faith that the strategy she has now been given is the best, the most achievable and the most acceptable. She and her squad gather, watching other bands of soldiers surge and spring across distant sections of the webbing. Her eyes stray to the high heavens. There is a new star up above now, and it foretells a time of terrible cataclysm and destruction simply by its appearance. There is no superstitious astrology in such predictions. The end times are truly here, the moment when one great cycle of history grinds inexorably into the next. The humans are coming. Chapter 7.3 Maiden, Mother, Crone.
What do you mean, wake, Lane?
Cast and Alpash turned to Holston, trying to read his suddenly agonized expression.
What it sounds like,
the security chief replied, baffled.
She's alive?
Holston's fingers crooked, fighting the urge to grab one or other of them and shake.
Why only wake her up now? Why isn't she in charge?
Cast obviously took issue with that, but Alpash stepped in quickly.
To wake Grandmother is not something to be done lightly, by her own orders.
Only in matters of emergency, she said. She told us when I next wake I want to walk upon a green planet.
She told you that, did she?
Holston demanded.
She told my mother, when she was very young, the engineer replied,
meeting the classicist's challenging stare easily. But it is recorded. We have records of many of Grandmother's later pronouncements. He bent over a console, calling up a display that shuddered patchily.
But we should go now.
Commander?
Yeah, well, I'll hold the fort here, shall I?
Cast said, plainly still smarting somewhat.
You get the woman up and on her feet and then link to me. Give her the situation and tell her that Vetus and I need to touch heads with her.
Alpash headed off into the ship, away from key crew, and most of the living areas that Holston was familiar with. The classicist hurried after him, not much wanting to be left with Cast, still less wanting to get lost within the flickering, ravaged spaces of the Gilgamesh. Everywhere told the same story of slow autolysis, a cannibalism of the self, as less important parts and systems were ripped out to fix higher priority problems. Walls were laid open, the ship's bones exposed. Screens flared static, or else were dark as wells. Here and there huddled small pockets of the tribe, still about the essential business of keeping the ship running, despite the immediate crisis, their heads close together like priests murmuring doctrine.
"How do you even know how to fix the ship?"
Halston asked of Alpash's back.
"It's been... I don't know how long it's been.
Since Guyan died, even.
I don't know. And you think you can still keep the ship running? Just by... what do you... you're learning how to make a spaceship run by rote, or..."
Alpash looked back at him, frowning. "Don't think I don't know what the commander means when he says... tribe. The chief scientist, too. It pleases them to think of us as primitives, inferiors. We, in turn, are bound to respect their... your... authority, as our precursors. That is what our grandmother laid down. That is one of our laws. But we do nothing by rote. We learn, all of us, from our youngest age. We have preserved manuals and lectures and tutorial models. Our grandmother has provided for us. Do you think we could do all we have done if we did not understand?"
He stopped, clearly angry.
Halston had obviously touched a nerve already rubbed raw by the other key crew.
"We are of the line of those who gave their lives, all of their lives, to preserve this vessel. That was and is our task, one to be undertaken without reward or hope of relief, an endless round of custodianship until we reach the planet we were promised. My parents, their parents and theirs, all of them have done nothing but ensure that you and all the other cargo of this ship shall live, or as much of them as we could save. And it pleases you to call us tribe, and consider us children and savages, because we never saw Earth."
Halston held his hands up appeasingly.
"I'm sorry. You've taken this up with Karst? I mean, he's kind of depending on you. You could make demands."
Alpash's look was incredulous.
"At this time, with the future of our home, our old home and our new, hanging in the balance, would you say that was a good time for us to start arguing amongst ourselves?"
For a moment, Halston studied the young man as though he was some completely new species of hominid, separated by a yawning cognitive gulf. The feeling passed, and he shook himself.
"She did well when she set down your laws," he murmured.
"Thank you." Alpash apparently took this as a validation of his entire culture, or whatever it was that had developed amongst his weird claustrophobic society.
"And now at last, I get to meet her. Here at the end of everything."
They passed on through a wide-open space that Halston suddenly recognised, the remembrance coming to him halfway across it, looking at the raised stage at one end, where stubs of broken machinery still jutted. Here, Guyan had stood and made his bid for eternity. Here, the earliest progenitors of Alpash's line had fought alongside their warrior queen and Karst's security team, some of whom were surely recently reawakened, possessing living memories of events that for Alpash must be song and story and weirdly twisted legend. A lone screen hung at an angle above the torn-up roots of the upload facility, flickering malevolently with scattered patterns. As though Guyan's ghost is still trapped inside there, Halston thought. Almost immediately, he thought he did see, for a broken moment, the rage-torn face of the old commander in the flurrying striations of the screen. Or perhaps it had been of Rana Kern's old empire features. Shuddering, he hurried on after Alpash. The place he ended up in had been a storeroom, he guessed. Now they stored only one thing there. A single suspension chamber. At the foot of the pedestal was a huddle of little objects, icons heat-moulded in plastic into an approximation of the female form, offerings from her surrogate children, and their children, to the guardian mother of the human race. Above that desperate little display of hope and faith were tacked little scraps of cloth torn from shipsuits, each bearing some close-written message. This was a shrine to a living goddess. Not only living, but awake. Alpash and a couple of other young engineers were standing back respectfully while Issa Lane found her balance, leaning on a metal spar. She was very frail, her earlier heaviness eaten away from her frame, leaving skin that was bagged and wrinkled and hung from her bones. Her near-bald scalp was mottled with liver spots, and her hands were like bird's claws, almost fleshless. She stood with a pronounced hunch, enough that Holston wondered if they'd altered the suspension chamber to let her sleep out the ages lying on her side. When she looked up at him, though, her eyes were Lane's eyes, clear and sharp and sardonic. If she had said then, "Hello, old man," like she used to, he was not sure that he could have borne it. She just nodded, however, as though nothing was to be more expected than to find Holston Mason standing there, looking young enough to be her son.
"Stop your bloody staring," she snapped a moment later.
"You don't look such a picture yourself, and what's your excuse?"
"Lane." He approached her carefully, as though even a strong movement of air might blow her away.
"No time for romance now, lover boy," she said dryly. "I hear Cast's fucked up, and we've got the human race to save."
And then she was in his arms, and he felt that fragile, thin-boned frame, felt her shaking suddenly as she fought the memories and the emotions.
"Get off me, you oaf,"
she said, but quietly, and she made no move to push him away.
"I'm just glad you're still with us," he whispered.
"For one more roll of the dice, anyway," she agreed. "I really did think that I might get some honest natural gravity and decent sunlight when they cracked me open. Was that too much to ask for?" "But apparently it was. I can't believe that I even have to do Karst's job these days."
"Don't be too hard on Karst," Holston cautioned her. "The situation is unprecedented."
"I'll be the judge of that."
At last she shook him off.
"I swear, sometimes I think I'm the only competent person left in the whole human race. I think that's the only thing keeping me going."
She made to stride past him, but stumbled almost immediately, and her next step was decidedly less ambitious, a careful hobble while leaning on her stick.
"Never grow old," she muttered. "Never grow old and then go into suspension, that's for sure. You dream young dreams. You forget what you're coming back to. Fucking disappointment, believe me."
"You don't dream in suspension," Holston corrected her.
"Look at you, the fucking expert,"
she glowered at him.
"Or am I not allowed to swear now? I suppose you expect some sort of fucking decorum."
Behind her defiance, there was a terrible desperation. A woman who had always been able to simply physically impose her will on the world, who now had to ask its permission, and the permission of her own body. Holston brought her up to date with developments, on the way back to join Karst. He could see her determinedly fitting each piece into place, and she wasn't slow to stop him and ask for clarification.
"These transmissions," she prompted. "Do we reckon they're actually from the planet, then?"
"I have no idea. It explains why most of it's completely incomprehensible, I suppose. It doesn't explain the stuff that sounds a bit like Imperial Sea. So maybe that is Kern."
"Have we tried talking to Kern?"
"I think Karst was planning everything on mounting a sneak attack."
"How subtle of him," she spat. "I reckon now's about the time to talk to Kern, don't you?"
She paused, breathing heavily.
"In fact, go do it now. Just get on with it. When we hit comms, I'll talk guns with Karst. You can talk whatever the fuck with Kern. Find out what she's saying. Maybe she doesn't actually like spiders crawling all over her. Maybe she's an ally now. You never know until you ask."
She had so much of her old sense of purpose still clinging to her, like the tatters of a once magnificent garment, that Holston was considerably heartened up, until the moment that she reached comms and saw what the drones were transmitting. Then Lane stopped in the hatchway and stared, exactly as aghast and lost as all the rest of them. For a moment all eyes were fixed on her, and if she had declared it all a lost cause then and there, there might have been nobody else willing to take up the baton. But she was Lane. She endured and she fought, whether satellites or spiders or time itself.
"Fuck,"
she said expressively, and then repeated it a few more times, as if taking strength from the word.
"Holston, get on the comms to Kern. Cast, get Vetus over here, and then you can start telling me just what the fuck we can do about that mess."
With the comms at his disposal, or at least after Alpash had explained half a dozen workarounds the engineers had come up with to deal with system instability, Holston wondered what he could possibly send. He had the satellite's frequency, but the space around the planet was alive with whispering ghosts, those faint transmissions that were, he had to admit now, not just signals from the satellite bouncing off the planet below it. He tried to feel some sort of awe about that, and about the unprecedented position that he was in. The only emotion he could muster was a worn-out dread. He began to assemble a message in his impeccable Imperial C, the dead language that looked to be about to survive the human race. "This is the Arkship Gilgamesh, calling for Dr. Avrana Kern." He stumbled over, "Do you require assistance?" His mind thronging with inappropriate possibilities. "Dr. Kern, you're covered in spiders." He took a deep breath. "This is the Arkship Gilgamesh calling Dr. Avrana Kern." And face it, she knew them and they knew her. They were old adversaries after all. "We are now without any option but to land on your planet. The survival of the human race is at stake. Please confirm that you will not impede us." It was a wretched plea. He knew that, even as he let the message fly off at the speed of light towards the planet. What could Kern say that would satisfy them? What could he say that would dissuade her from her monomaniacal purpose? Vetus had arrived by then, and she, Cast, and Lane had their heads close together, discussing the important stuff, whilst Holston was left babbling into the void. Then a reply arrived, or something like it. It was sent from the point in the web that Cast had figured to be the satellite, and it was far stronger than the feeble transmissions he had been analysing before. There seemed little doubt that it was directed at and intended for the Gilgamesh. If it was Kern, it seemed she was long gone. It was not her crisp, antique speech, but more of the weird, almost imperial, that he had caught before. A jumble of nonsense and letter strings that looked like words but weren't, and in the midst of them all, a few words, and what might even be sentence fragments, like an illiterate aping writing from memory. An illiterate with access to a radio, and the ability to encode a signal. He resent his signal, asking for Eliza this time. What was there to lose? The return was more of the same. He contrasted it with its predecessor, some repeated sections, some new ones, and by now his professional eye was seeing certain recurring patterns in those sections he could not interpret. Kern was trying to tell them something, or at least something was trying to tell them something. He wondered if it was still simply go away, and if that was the case, would it now be a warning for their benefit? Turn back before it's too late? But there was no back for them. They were now on a one-way journey towards the only potentially viable destination they could possibly reach. He pondered what he might be able to send so as to jolt Kern into some semblance of comprehensible sentience. Or was Kern, too, now a failing machine? Was the end coming for all of the works of human hands, even as it was for their masters? It seemed intolerable that the universe could be left to the creators of that planet-spanning web, to a legion of insensate crawling things that could never know the trials and hardships that poor humanity had suffered. A new message was being broadcast at them on the same frequency. Holston listened to it dully, not even a mimicry of language now, just numerical codes. To his shame, it was the Gilgamesh that recognised it, rather than he himself. It was the signal that Kern had, once upon a time, been sending down towards the planet. It was her intelligence test for monkeys. Without much examination of his motives, Holston composed the answers, with help from the Gilgamesh towards the end, and sent it back. Another battery of questions followed, new ones this time.
What is it?
Lane was at his shoulder, just like old times. If he didn't look back, he could even fool himself that rather less water had flowed under the bridge since they were first playing this game.
Curran's testing us, he told her. Maybe she wants to see if we're worthy.
By setting us a maths exam?
She never made much sense at the best of times, so why not?
Get her the answers, then. Come on.
Holston did so, finding it so much quicker to assemble a response once the complexities of actual language were removed from the equation.
Of course, we have no idea of the purpose of this, he pointed out.
But we can still hope it has a purpose, she replied crisply.
Holston was vaguely aware of Vetus and Cast hovering in the background, impatient to get on with talking about the offensive. There was no third round of the test. Instead, they got another blast of the maddeningly near-to-Imperial Sea that Holston had seen before. He analysed it swiftly, passing it through his decoders and pattern recognition functions. It seemed simpler than before, and with more repeated patterns. The phrase came to him, like talking to a child, and he experienced another of those vertiginous moments, wondering who or what it was that was speaking far out there.
Curran, surely?
But Curran made strange, stranger, by the curdling effects of time and distance. But even though Curran's little sentry habitat was the origination point of the signal, a part of him understood already that this was not so.
I can identify some words used frequently, he announced hoarsely, after he and his suite of programs had finished their work.
He could not keep the quaver out of his tones.
I found what's definitely a form of the verb approach, and the word near, and some other indicators I'd associate with permission or agreement.
That pronouncement got the thoughtful silence it deserved.
They've changed their tune, then, Cast remarked at last. You said it was all fuck off before.
It was, Holston nodded. It's changed.
Because Kern's in desperate need of our superior math skills?
The security chief demanded.
Holston opened his mouth, then shut it, unwilling to make his suspicions real by voicing them aloud. Lane did it for him.
If it's actually Curran.
Who else?
But there was a raw edge to Cast's voice that showed he was not such a blunt tool after all.
There's no evidence that anything but Curran exists to transmit from there, Vetus said sharply.
What about that?
Holston jabbed a finger at the screen, still showing the drone's images.
We have no way of knowing what has transpired down on that planet. It was an experiment, after all. It may be that what we're seeing is an aberration of that experiment, just as was the grey planet and its fungal growth. The point remains that the Curran satellite is still present there, and it's where the signal comes from, Vetus set out doggedly.
Or it may be, Lane started.
It's possible, Vetus cut her off.
The very suggestion seemed abhorrent to her.
It changes nothing.
Right, Cast backed her up. I mean, even if they're... If Kern's saying, yeah, come on down, what do we do? Because if she's got all her stuff, she can cut us up as we touch orbit. And that's not even thinking about that bastard mess and what that could do. I mean, if it's something that's grown up from the planet, well, it's Kern's experiment, isn't it? Maybe it does what she says.
There was an awkward pause, everyone waiting to see if someone, anyone, would argue the other side, just for the form of it. Holston turned the words over, trying to put together a sentence that didn't sound flat-out crazy.
There was a tradition the old empire once had,
Vetus stated slowly.
It was a choice they gave to their criminals, their prisoners. They would take two of them and ask them to spare or to accuse each other, each making the decision quite alone, without a chance to confer. All went very well indeed if they both chose to spare one another, but they suffered some degree of punishment if they both accused each other. But oh, if you were the prisoner who decided to spare his friend, only to find you'd been accused in turn.
She smiled, and in that smile Holston saw suddenly that she had grown old, but that it showed so little on her face. kept at bay by all the expressions she did not give rein to.
"So what was the right choice?"
Cast asked her.
"How did the prisoners get out of it?"
The logical choice depended on the stakes, the weighting of punishments for the different outcomes, Beatus explained. "I'm afraid the facts and the stakes here are very stark and very plain. We could approach the planet in the hope that we were, against all past experience, now being welcomed. As Cast says, that will leave us vulnerable. We will put the ship at risk if it turns out that this is really a trick, or even that Mason has simply made some error in his translation." Her eyes passed over Holston, daring him to object, but in truth he was by no ways that confident of his own abilities. "Or we attack. Use the drones now, and prepare to back up that first strike when the Gilgamesh reaches the planet. If we do that, and we are wrong, we are throwing away a priceless chance to reach an accommodation with an old Empire intelligence of some sort." There was genuine regret in her voice. "If we go in peace, and we are wrong, we are most likely all dead. All of us. All the human race. I don't think we can argue with the weighting that we have been given. For me, there is only one rational choice at this point." Cast nodded grimly.
"That bitch never liked us," he pointed out. "No way she'd suddenly change her mind."
"Several centuries later and a lot of spiders is a long way from suddenly," Holston thought, but the words stayed unspoken in his head. Lane was looking at him, though, obviously expecting a contribution. So now people actually want to listen to the classicist. He just shrugged. He suspected that the loss, if they went to war on false pretenses, might be far greater than Vetus claimed, but he could not argue with her assessment of the complete total loss of everything there was if they erred too far on the path of peace. "More importantly, the logic is universal," Vetus added, looking from face to face. "It truly doesn't matter what is waiting for us at the planet. It's mathematics, that's all. Our adversary faces the same choice, the same waiting. Even if to welcome us with open arms and have us then play the responsible guest may give the best results all round, the cost of being betrayed is too high. So we can look into the minds of our opponents. We know that they must make the same decision that we must make, because the cost of fighting needlessly is so much less than the cost of opting for peace and getting it wrong. And that same logic will inform the decision of whatever is there, whether it's a human mind or a machine or spiders." But it was plain that Vetus wouldn't even utter the word. And when Lane spoke it for her, the science chief twitched ever so slightly. "So Vetus doesn't like spiders," Holston considered morosely. "Well, she wasn't down on the bloody planet, was she? She didn't see those bloated monsters." His eyes strayed to the image of the webbed world. Can it be sentience? Or is Vetus right and it's just some mad experiment gone wrong? Gone right, even. Would the old Empire have wanted giant space spiders for some purpose? Why not? As a historian, I must concur that they did a lot of stupid things.
"Come on, then," Cast prompted. "I'm pressing the button, or what?"
In the end, everyone was looking at Lane. The old engineer took a few careful steps forward, stick clacking on the floor, staring at the drone's camera image of the shrouded planet. Her eyes, that had witnessed centuries pass in a kind of punctuated stop motion, tried to take it all in. She had the look of a woman staring bleak destiny in the eye.
"Take out the satellite," she decided at last, quietly.
"We go in fighting. You're right. There's too much at stake. There's everything at stake. Bring it down."
Cast sent the order briskly, as though afraid that someone would get cold feet or change their mind. Millions of kilometres away, in the direction of the Gilgamesh's inexorable progress, the drones received their instructions. They already had the metal fist of the satellite targeted, trapped as it was in that vast equatorial web. They carried the best lasers that the tribe had been able to restore, linked to the remote vessel's little fusion reactors. They had already drifted as close as they dared, jockeying for geostationary orbit above the trapped satellite, with as little expenditure of energy as they could get away with. They loosed, the two of them together, striking at the same spot on the satellite's hull. Somewhere far distant, Karst would be tensing, but the image he would be reacting to would already be old by the time he saw it. For a moment, nothing happened, as energy was poured into the ancient, ravaged shell of the Bryn II sentry pod. Karst would have his fists clenched, staring at the screens with veins standing out on his forehead, as though his will could cross space and time in order to make things happen. Then, with a silent flowering of fire almost instantly extinguished, the drilling beams reached something vital within, and the millennia-old home of Dr. Avrana Kern was ripped open, the webs on either side shriveling and springing away under the sudden excess of heat. Still gouting out its contents into the hungry emptiness of space, the shattered satellite slipped free from its tangle of moorings, burning a hole in the great web, and was propelled away from the drones by the outrush of material from its jagged wounds. The drones themselves had given their all, the discharge of their weapons leaving their reactors cold and draining them dry. They tumbled off across the face of the web, to fall or to drift away. The satellite, though, had a more definite fate. It fell. Like Kern's experimental subjects so very, very long before, it was jolted out of its orbit, to be gathered up by the arms of the planet's gravity, spiralling helplessly into the atmosphere, where it streaked across the sky, just an old barrel with a single ancient monkey in withered residence, delivering a final message to the anxious eyes below. Chapter 7.4 End Times. They watched it burn its way across the sky. Although active messenger worship was almost non-existent in these more enlightened times, what need of faith when there was ample proof of the precise nature of God, the spiders watched that fiery trail, either with their own eyes or through the surrogate eyes of their biological systems, and knew that something had gone out of their world. The messenger had always been there. They retained the memories of distant, primitive times, when that moving light in the heavens had been both compass and inspiration to them. They recalled the heady days of temple, and the earliest communications shared between God and her congregation. Something that has been a part of their cultural consciousness from their earliest times, something that they know, rationally, to be older than their very species, and now it is gone. In the quiet dark of his work chamber, Fabian feels a shock of emotion go through him that he had not expected. He, of all spiders, is not religious. He has no time for the unknowable, save to pin it down by experiment and reason, and thus make it knowable. Still, he has been watching, on a filmy screen, the image formed from thousands of tiny chromatopores of various colours, expanding and contracting to form pinpoint parts of the overall picture. Deep underground, as his chambers are, there is no chance of him witnessing this first-hand. He is a pallid, angular, unkempt specimen of his species, and seldom cares much about seeing the sun. Instead, he works to his own rhythms that have little to do with day or night. "Well," he remarks to his only constant companion, "I suppose that backs up everything you've told us." "Of course." The response comes from the very walls, an invisible presence all around him like a familiar demon. "And you must retaliate at the first opportunity. They will give you no chances." "The connection peer group seemed to be having some success, just before," Fabian notes. The curved walls of the chamber around him seethe and crawl. A thousand ants engaged in the inscrutable bustle of activity that allows this colony, a supercolony really, risen again after all this time, to function in the unique way that it does. "There was never any chance of their success. I am only glad that they have been shown this unequivocal demonstration of the enemy's intent. I am concerned about the strategy to be employed, however. It is a strange thing, this bodiless speech. Muscular pistons in the walls create the vibrations that simulate a spider's elegant footfalls. Elsewhere, the thing communicates by radio still. But here, Fabian can speak to it as though it was a spider. A particularly aloof, temperamental female, he considers, but still a spider. It speaks in that curious negotiated language that was long ago devised for communication between the spiders and their god. But recently it has taken to bringing up a pair of phantom palps on the screens to add emphasis to its language, adopting a bizarre pidgin of the spider's own visual language. Fabian, who has never been comfortable much with his own kind, finds it congenial company. That, and his unarguable skill with chemical architecture and conditioning, has earned him this vital role. He is the hands and the confidant of the messenger, as she is now. I wonder if there was anything left, at the end, of me. The words were slow, hesitant. At first Fabian wonders if another glitch has developed in the machinery, or possibly in the colony's conditioning. Then he decides that this is one of those times when his companion is dredging up some remnant intonation or rhythm of speech that it might have used in another age, in another form. Dr. Avrana Khan, he addresses it. It does not like him to call it God or messenger. After long haggling, they have found a form of arbitrary movements that seem to recall to it the name it once went by. It is one of many idiosyncrasies that Fabian is happy to indulge. He has a special relationship with God, after all. He is her closest friend. He is responsible for maintaining her proper functioning and untangling any errors in her conditioning. Around him, in a network of tunnels and chambers, the geography of which is constantly being altered, dwells a colony of 100 million insects. Their interactions are not as fast as an electronic system built by human hands, but each insect's tiny brain is itself a capable engine for data storage and decision-making, and the overall calculating power of the colony as a whole is something that even it cannot assess. Cloud computing. Not speed, but an infinitely reconfigurable breadth and complexity. There is more than enough room for the downloaded mind of Avrana Khan. It took a long time to work out how to do it, but in the end she was only information after all. Everything is only information, if you have sufficient capacity to encompass it. A long time, too, to copy that information from satellite to a holding colony on the surface. A much longer time, for what they had downloaded to organize itself to the extent that it could say, I am. But it is now, and they have had a long time. The colony that Fabian lives within and tends is God made flesh, the incarnation of the messenger. Fabian opens radio contact with one of the orbital observatories and checks on the approach of the enemy, which is in a trajectory that confirms it will be seeking orbit around their world. This is a time for waiting, now. Across the planet, they are all waiting. Not just the spiders, but all those species they have connected with. They will all be under the hammer soon, facing, with their numbers and their ingenuity, a species that created them without ever meaning to, and now seeks to erase them just as thoughtlessly. There are spiders, ant colonies, stomatopods in the ocean, semi-sentient beetles, and a dozen others of varying proportions of intellect and instinct, all in some faint way aware that the end times are here. Up on the orbital web, Bianca can plan no more. Portia waits with her peers, ready to fight the returning space gods. For now, they can only cling to their webs, as the extended senses their technology gives them track the approach of the end. And then, the great bulk of the Gilgamesh is drawing close, at the end of its long deceleration, its ailing thrusters fighting to slow it to the point where the momentum of a dive past the planet will mesh with the reaching gravity and bring the Ark ship into orbit. Although they have been aware of the dimensions of the enemy from their own measurements and Kern's records, the sheer scale of the Gilgamesh is awe-inspiring. More than one spider must be thinking, how can we fight such a thing? And then the Ark ship's weapons unleash their fire. Its approach has been calculated to put the equatorial web in the sights of its forward-facing asteroid lasers, and in that fleeting pass, the Gilgamesh makes full use of its window of opportunity. The web has no centre, no vital point where a surgical strike might cause widespread damage, and so the lasers just sear out indiscriminately, frying strands, cutting open nodes, tearing great gashes in the overall structure of the web. Spiders die, exposed suddenly to vacuum, thrown out into space or inwards towards the planet, some few even vaporized by the incendiary wrath of the lasers themselves. Portia receives damage reports even as she and her warrior peer group prepare for their counterattack. She is aware that they have just lost, in one searing instant, a certain number of soldiers, a certain proportion of their weapons, all just blindly snuffed out. Bianca confers with her, her radio vibrating with electric current to simulate the dancing rhythms of speech. The battle plan is unchanged, Bianca confirms. She will already have a complete picture of what they have lost and what they still have. Portia does not envy her the task of coordinating all their orbital defences. Are you ready for deployment?
We are.
Portia feels a swelling of angry determination at the destruction. The deaths, the destruction of the messenger, the heedless brutality of it all, fire her up with righteous zeal. We will show them. We will show them, Bianca echoes, sounding equally determined. You are the swiftest, the strongest, the cleverest. You are the defenders of your world. If you fail, then it will be as though we never lived at all. All our understandings will be nothing but dust. I ask you to keep the plan in mind at all times. I know that some of you have qualms. This is not the time for them. The great minds of our people have determined that what you are to do is what must be done, if we are to preserve who and what we are. We understand. Portia is aware that the great star-blotting form of the Ark ship is nearing. Already other detachments are launching. Good hunting, Bianca exhorts them all. All around, the orbital weapons of the web are in action. Each consists of a single piece of debris, a rock hauled up by the space elevator or captured from the void, held under enormous tension within the net, and now suddenly released, hurled at great speed into the vacuum towards the Ark ship. But tiny, Portia considers. Those vast boulders she remembers seeing are nothing to the Ark ship. Surely its shell must be proof against any such missiles. But the spiders are not simply throwing rocks. The hurled missiles have multiple purposes, but mostly they are a distraction. Portia feels the webbing tense around her. Ensure your lines are properly coiled, she sends to her peers. This will be rough. Seconds later, she and her peers are flung into the void on an oblique line that will intercept the Gilgamesh's pass as it enters a stable orbit. She clutches her legs tightly into her body by instinct at first, a shock of terror erupting in her mind and threatening to overwhelm her. Then her training takes over and she begins checking on her soldiers. They are spreading out as they fall towards their rendezvous with the Gilgamesh, but they are still linked by lines to a central hub, forming a rotating wheel, just one of many now spinning towards the Gilgamesh. The Ark ship's lasers burn the first few rocks, heating them explosively, at carefully calculated points to send them tumbling out of its path. Others slam into the vast vessel's sides, rebounding or embedding. Portia sees at least one thin plume of lost air from a lucky or unlucky strike. Then she and her peers are bracing for impact. Her radio feeds them second-by-second instructions from the computing colonies on the orbital web to help them slow down their approach with their little jets and their meagre supply of propellant. Portia is very aware that this is quite likely to be a one-way trip. If they fail, there will be nothing to journey back to. She has slowed as much as she is able, spinning out more line from the centre of the wheel to put her further away from her sisters. She spreads her legs and hopes that she has managed to do away with just enough momentum. She lands badly, fails to catch hold with the hooks of her insulated gloves, bounds back from the Gilgamesh's hull. Others of her team have been luckier, and now they latch on with six legs and reel in their errant peers, Portia included. One is unluckier, landing at an angle and smashing her mask. She dies in an agonized flurry of twitching legs, her helpless cries coming to her companions through the metal of the hull. There is no time for sentiment. Her corpse is secured to the hull with a little webbing, and then they are on the move. They have a war to fight, after all. We will show them, Portia thinks. We will show them the error of their ways. Chapter 7.5 Maneuvers.
Rocks! They're throwing rocks at us, Cast declared incredulously. They're Space Age Stone Age!
One of the console displays flickered and went out, and others began to dot with baleful amber displays.
Cast, this isn't a warship,
Lane's brittle voice snapped.
The Gilgamesh wasn't designed for any sort of stresses except acceleration and deceleration, certainly not impact. We have a hull breach in cargo,
Alpash reported, sounding as though someone had trampled over his holy places.
Internal doors are...
For a moment, apparently, it wasn't clear whether they were or weren't, but then he got out,
sealed off. The section's sealed off. We have cargo loss.
Cargo is already in vacuum, or close to. Exposure shouldn't cause any harm, Vitas broke in.
We have damage to 49 chambers, Alpash told her, from the impact and from electrical surges resulting from the damage. 49!
For a moment, nobody felt up to following that. Half a hundred deaths from a single hit. Trivial, compared to the overall cargo manifest. Horrifying, though, to go behind that word cargo and think about the implications.
We're in orbit, 180 kilometers out from the web, Cast said. We need to fight back. They'll be throwing more stones at us.
Will they? Halston's meagre contribution.
Maybe they're reloading.
What other damage? Vitas asked.
I don't know, Alpash admitted. Hull sensors are
unreliable, and some have been lost.
I don't believe any essential systems have been damaged, but there may be weakening of the hull in other areas. Our damage control systems have been refined so as to concentrate on emergencies and critical areas.
Meaning that they simply haven't been able to properly maintain the entire network.
We can reposition the lasers, Cast stated,
as though it was a natural sequitur to what had last been said. Perhaps in Cast's head it was.
We can probably reposition the ship rather more easily, Lane told him. Just turn him round so that the asteroid arrays are aiming towards the web. In orbit, our orientation doesn't matter.
Cast blinked at that, obviously still somewhat married to the idea that the front end should go first, but then he nodded.
Well, let's start on that then. How long?
Depends how responsive the systems are. We may need to do some spot repairs.
We may not have. Fuck off, Cast. I am literally in the same boat as you. I will do it as fast as can be done.
Well, right,
Cast grimaced, apparently remembering that his status as acting commander had been sidelined once they woke up Lane. The ancient engineer lowered herself in front of one of the working consoles, a handful of her tribe gathered around her to do her bidding. She looked terribly tired, Halston thought, and yet there was still an energy to her he recognised. Time had fought with Lane for possession of this bent, fragile body, and so far time had lost.
We are simply not going to be able to burn our way to control of the planet, Vitas stated.
Sure we are, Cast said stubbornly. Seriously, we can probably cut across that entire web, just send it fucking off into space like an old sock or something.
And then,
shut up, Halston,
when the classicist seemed about to take issue with his simile.
Cast, please check the available power to the asteroid array, Vitas said patiently.
Cast scowled. So, we recharge them.
Using all the energy that is currently ensuring that systems like life support or reactor containment keep working, Vitas agreed.
And even if you get it right, what then? What about the planet, Cast?
The planet? He blinked at her. You were planning to just trip down there in a shuttle and plant a flag?
If that's what near orbit looks like, what do you think you'd find on the surface? You're going to laser all of that too, are you? Or will you take a disruptor?